Yeah. All right. My name is Angela Potter. Today is June 19th, 2015, here with Walter Tinsley. And this is part of the Central State Oral History Project. A complete biography will accompany this recording. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this. So can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born here in Indianapolis on April 16th, 1923.
Okay. And did you grow up here in Indianapolis then?
Yes. Went to grammar school and high school here.
Where'd you go to high school?
Shortridge.
Oh, at Shortridge. So when did you decide that you wanted to be a doctor?
Well, I can't tell you exactly, but very early on, my father and grandfather were both physicians.
Oh.
And I just thought that was the thing to do.
Oh, it makes sense. So what was your father a physician here in Indianapolis?
Yes.
And did he have just general practice?
Yes.
And where did he go to medical school?
Indiana University.
Oh, wow. So you probably didn't really have much of a choice then when it was your turn to decide where to go.
Well, that was where I thought I wanted to go.
Uh-huh.
And so I did.
So where did you do your preparation for medical school? Where did you go to college?
Well, I graduated from Shortridge High School.
Uh-huh.
In, let's see, that was 1941.
Uh-huh.
And Pearl Harbor came along in December of 41, and so I decided better get started on college, and I started at Butler.
Mm-hmm.
And went to Butler for a semester, the spring semester, and then I followed that up with the summer semester, and then a short 3-week post-summer semester, and then transferred down to Bloomington, and was there for until I went into the Navy V-12 program, and did not have a Navy V-12 program at IU, so they sent me to DePaul. Mm-hmm. And I was there for a couple or three semesters, finished up my pre-med, and then transferred back to IU for medical school. I had the misfortune of flunking or not passing the course in neuroanatomy, and there was no makeup that time, so I had to drop out of the V-12 program and was shipped to Great Lakes. Naval training for reclassification, and then went from there to Hospital Corps School in California and San Diego, and finished that, and was transferred back across the United States to Long Island Naval Hospital at St. Albans, Long Island, and stayed there until I was discharged.
So what did you do in these hospitals? What was your role?
Well, when I first got to St. Albans, I assigned to the diet kitchen, and I, along with another fellow, we had the keys to the refrigerator, and the cooks were, we worked in the kitchen, the cooks were the civilian employees, and we doled out the necessary ingredients for them to prepare the meals for the hospital. The special diet, this was not the for kitchen for the entire hospital.
It was
a special diet kitchen. And then I got finally got out of that job and got a position at the admissions desk, or the not the admissions, but the visitors' admission desk, and spent the rest of my time in there in the admissions. And then was sent to Brooklyn Navy Yard and was discharged there.
So when were you discharged?
Oh,
you remember what year it was?
Not exactly. I could figure it out, but I can't tell you offhand.
Okay.
But
so then what did you do next?
I went back to Bloomington, reapplied for medical school, and turned down, and so I enrolled and finished my bachelor's degree, got a B.S., or I mean a A.B., Bachelor of Arts in zoology, and reapplied to medical school and was accepted, and went back to medical school again and graduated in 1952.
I bet there was a lot of former service people in your class at medical school?
Yes, it was probably of the male population. It was 90% former service, and there were about five women in the class, and but the rest were male, as opposed to medical school nowadays, which is 50% or better female.
What did you think of the women in your class?
Well, there were, let's see, they were all pretty good students except one, she wasn't, and she dropped out after the first year. I don't think she flunked out, but she dropped out.
So was it easier the second time around?
Well, yes. a different professor in neuroanatomy, which was my failing course, and he had a different approach, and I got along just fine.
So you graduated in 1952. In medical school, what were you thinking, that you wanted to be a specialty, or did you want to be a general practitioner?
I went through with the idea of being a general practitioner, and when I finished my internship, I expected to be drafted because I was still, as far as I knew, let's see what the 1A. And when I hadn't heard anything about it, well, I when I finished up my last service and my internship was anesthesiology, and so I fell and I heard that the Methodist Hospital was hiring general practitioners to do anesthesia in the mornings. And so I went over there and applied in 1st of July, and they hired me to do anesthesia in the obstetrical department. And so I did that for probably a month or so, and I hadn't heard anything from the draft board, so I contacted them, and they said, "Oh, didn't you get a notice? You're no longer 1A because of your prior service. You're not going to be drafted."
Oh.
And so I decided I'd better look for a place and start in practice. And I told them I was going to resign my position in the obstetrical department, and they asked me if I was interested in working in surgery. And since I didn't have any practice or any income or anything, I said, sure, that'd be fine. And I went up to the, moved upstairs to the surgery department, and started there doing anesthesia in the mornings. And I did that, and I finally opened my general practice in the Eagledale area of Indianapolis. And after about 16 years of doing anesthesia at Methodist in the mornings and my general practice in the afternoons and evenings, I decided I'd need to either go one way or the other, and I chose to take a residency in anesthesia.
Oh.
And then spent the rest of my practice in anesthesia.
Did you do your residency at Methodist then?
Yes, I did residency there.
And did you work most of your career there?
Yes.
Yeah.
For all the rest of us, then I stayed there.
Wow.
Practicing anesthesia.
Yeah. So you must have seen a lot of changes in anesthesia over the time of your career.
Yeah, I did. And the development of several anesthetic drugs that were not available when I first started came along, and so there were some changes in practice methods.
Did you continue any connections with the medical school at IU over your practice?
No.
No. Did you have residents that you supervised? Did residents in anesthesia work at Methodist?
Yes, I was the first anesthesia resident. They'd had an anesthesia residency program a good many years before, but they dropped it, and I was the first one to restart anesthesia as an anesthesia resident. Residency then was 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and then there were about, I was followed by about four or five men in residency for anesthesia there before Methodist dropped their residency program again, because the truth of the matter was that it had a better one at the medical center.
Mm. All right. So when did you come out to Central State when you were a medical student?
Yes. I came out to Central State one day a week. One afternoon a week. During the junior year, and had lectures in neuropsychiatry and in the amphitheater.
In the amphitheater?
We also toured the hospital a time or two. They presented patients from the hospital to us in the amphitheater.
So do you remember what your impressions were of Central State coming out here?
Well, at that time the women's building was still here, and it was a big, huge building, and was very impressive to, I remember touring there, and of course they had, they brought patients over from the hospital to the amphitheater to demonstrate certain
mm-hmm.
Mental problems, and certainly was impressed by the size. At that time they probably had somewhere in the neighborhood in excess of 800 or 900 patients at that time, and
that's still a big facility even today.
Yeah, well, it of course they don't have any patients here.
Right.
No,
I just meant a hospital that had 800 or 900 patients would be.
Yeah, well, at its peak, I believe it had something like 1,200.
Yeah. So then, when did you come back to Central State? When was the next time that you interacted with out here?
Well, at that time, the Marion County Medical Society Auxiliary, which was made up primarily of physicians' wives,
mm-hmm.
Was quite active, and they advertised in their newsletter that they were needing some volunteers for the Medical History Museum, which had just gotten organized and started a few years before that.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife volunteered and came out here and worked, and she told me about the Medical History Museum and about it. So when I retired, I came and joined
mm-hmm.
her here and volunteered.
Now, I forgot to ask you about your wife. Where did you meet your wife?
At the medical center. She was a bacteriologist and worked in a laboratory in Riley Hospital. Mm-hmm. And when I was a senior medical student, I had a part-time job caring for the animals. There was an animal room on the top floor of Riley Hospital at that time.
Uh-huh.
And several of us that were medical students had part-time jobs taking care of those animals up there, cleaning cages,
uh-huh.
feeding and so uh-huh. forth. And her boss, Dr. Walser, was in charge of the animal room.
Uh-huh.
And so we had to come down to his laboratory and collect our paychecks.
Oh, uh-huh.
And so it happened that Jean had the job of passing out the paychecks.
Oh.
And that's where we met.
That's where you met. So what kind of training did she have for her job?
She went graduated in bacteriology at the University of Tennessee.
Oh.
She had a bachelor's degree in bacteriology.
So, when did you guys get married then?
We got married in 54, I believe it was.
So you were finished with medical school then?
Yeah, I graduated in 52.
Right.
And internship in 53.
Okay.
And we got married in 54.
Okay. So, do you know about when she started volunteering out here, approximately?
Oh, yes, approximately. Was probably, she came, as I think I mentioned before, she was here maybe a couple of years at least before I came out.
Uh-huh.
And so it must have been about 86, something like that.
And when did you retire?
I retired in 1988.
Okay. So what was the museum like then?
Well, it was not nearly as active as it is now. It didn't have any educational programs as such. Had very few visitors, and it was mostly a case of receiving and cataloging artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
It was only open for visitors. When it first came out, I think we were only open one day a week. And there was no educational program.
Uh-huh. Now, the hospital was still open then.
Yes.
And did you have any interaction with the hospital at that time?
Not really.
Not really?
That I can recall.
Were you able to see patients walking around, or was it pretty separated from the
It was pretty separated. By that time, they had torn down the women's building.
Mm-hmm.
And so the patient population, or the women's building originally was right across the road from the pathology building.
Right.
The patient population was moved much farther to the south.
Mm.
And in the buildings that were had been constructed
mm-hmm.
later on.
So you mentioned that this your wife started because of the women's auxiliary. Were a lot of the volunteers mostly women or retired physicians?
Well, they were mostly women, I think, at that time.
Okay. And so what were some of the volunteer activities that you did? You mentioned cataloging artifacts. So did they ask you to help them identify the artifacts, or?
Yes, I did. I did some tours.
Mm-hmm.
And I also identified and cataloged artifacts.
Okay. And is that what your wife did as well?
Yes. She
okay.
didn't do any tours. She just worked with the collection.
Okay. So then, I know that you're still doing that today, but, was there a board for the museum?
Yes, I, was asked after a period of time, I can't remember anything more, but I was asked to join the board,
mm-hmm.
and I served on the board for a year and a half or maybe 2 years, and then became president of the board, and served as president for probably maybe 4 years, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then served for a while as secretary of the board after that. So I probably served on the board for maybe close to 6 years.
Okay.
That was before the board initiated the policy of board members, I think now, are only served for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was sort of hanging on as long as somebody would
be willing.
Be willing, yes.
So, at this time, was there any paid staff at the museum?
Yes, there was one part-time lady, Catherine Menduzik
mm-hmm.
McDonald, and she was director at that time, and she split her time between here and the Indiana Historical Society.
Mm.
And she had a degree, I believe, in medical history.
Mm. So, what were the things that the board was interested in at that time?
Oh, primarily probably maintaining the building.
Mm-hmm.
They were not particularly interested in education or
mm-hmm.
Promoting the museum, I don't believe. seems like that we did carry out some fundraising, so it was maintaining the building and fundraising primarily.
So when did the museum start to become more educationally focused?
Well, Kathy McDonald was succeeded by a young man by the name of Orrin Cooley, and he began to he developed some exhibits and opened up to more visiting, more opened it up to the public more, and then he was succeeded by Virginia Turpinning, and she probably she took on she was here today.
She took on more project, more educational projects.
Yeah, well, she hired a part-time person to do what Elizabeth does now, be the education and
program.
Well, I can't think of her name. As I say, she was here today.
Okay, it's fine. I can look it up. I can look it up. That's fine.
Yeah, Elizabeth can tell you. Like that.
I'm amazed everything you can tell me. I can't hardly remember last week, let alone all these years ago. So were there any surprises that you had or any problems that you had when you were a volunteer out here?
No, not as a volunteer. We at that time we were receiving quite a lot of artifacts, and so we were real busy cataloging, and
did you know what most things were, or did you have a lot of things that stumped you?
Well, we have another number of old catalogs here and things, and so we had references to look up things if you didn't know what they were. And we got a number of artifacts that we knew they were, most of them are surgical instruments of some sort, and but there were also a number of electrical apparatuses that were used in therapy. The therapy probably should be in quotation marks, because they really probably didn't do anything, but they were impressive. And with this array of catalogs, most of those books in front of you there are catalogs and have medical instruments, primarily surgical, that were used. Some of them go back almost 100 years.
I bet a lot of the surgical instruments were somewhat familiar to you, since you'd probably spent so much time in surgeries over your career?
Yes. Some of them I didn't have any trouble identifying at all. But there were some that were old enough that they had fallen out of use.
Yeah.
Just like some that the things that I used and saw used have probably fallen out of use.
Right.
In the meantime.
Yeah. So is there any of the collection that sticks out as particularly memorable to you? Something that you ran across over your time here?
Well, I have to think about there are, of course we have another thing such as we have a couple of iron lungs, and which are no longer in use or available.
Thank goodness.
We have polio vaccine pretty well eliminated the need for those. And we have a number of electrical apparatuses that were probably not really very effective, but were used in treatment, and we have quite a group of examining tables which give a history of the development of the examining and operative tables. One particular company was located here in Indianapolis and made quite a line of examining and operating tables for several years.
So, thinking back on your career in anesthesiology, what would you say was the biggest change over the time you were in anesthesiology?
Well, probably one of the biggest changes was the development of the techniques necessary to open the chest and do surgery on the heart and lungs, and the development of the heart-lung machine.
So did you work on was that something you did a lot, working with?
I gave a good many, I gave anesthesia for open heart surgery during my career. That was a field of treatment that became developed during that period of time. When I first started back before I took my residency and devoted myself entirely to anesthesiology, there was no such thing as opening a chest.
Right. I bet it was pretty interesting to see the heart beating, and I mean, do you remember seeing that for the first time and the first few surgeries that you did?
Yes. As a resident, I of course observed and watched an anesthesiologist who was trained in open heart surgery, and that was and the use of the heart lung machine, and that was very impressive.
I imagine that heart lung machine was still pretty primitive, though.
Yes, I saw the development of particularly the methods of oxygenating the blood with the heart lung machine. There was quite a a metamorphosis of methods of oxygenation.
Yeah, it seems like anesthesia would be a kind of medicine that's got a lot of technology in it.
Well, yes, there was a good bit of technology, and you sort of had the responsibility for the maintenance of the patient while the surgery was going on. Maybe not so much so with open heart surgery, actually, as with other types of surgery.
So did you mostly work on in a certain types of surgery, or how specialized were you?
During the years, I did almost everything. I gave anesthetics for this gentleman sitting behind me.
Oh, and he survived, it looks like.
Well, I don't mean to him. I gave
for
his patients.
For his patients, okay. Yeah.
And both of them survived.
Both of them survived. Well, that's good.
And yes, when I started out, when I was doing the anesthesia, just on the basis of my last month of internship training, it was mostly ether.
Right.
And ether and pentothal. And then I saw the development of other inhalation agents, and more use of muscle relaxants and things of that came along.
The ether could be pretty dangerous, couldn't it?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch
it. It could be the ether, administering ether was dangerous?
Well, that administering any anesthetic agent is dangerous.
Right.
Because actually, all general anesthetic agents depend on depressing the central nervous system.
Right.
And if you depress it too much, you lose the patient.
Right. I just met ether. I think I've read about fires and things like that.
Well, that was a problem. I did have an incident with a tonsillectomy in which we had a flare up of flame. And so there was the hazard of fire.
Was doing anesthesia with children particularly difficult?
No, not not really so. Techniques changed in how you went about the induction of anesthesia with children, and you went from an open drop ether induction and open drop ether anesthesia through the resection of the tonsils, where where patients were intubated, and for even children for tonsillectomies.
Okay. So, just to follow up, how many children did you have?
Three.
Were they girls or boys?
Two girls and one boy.
Okay. And do you have any grandchildren?
Yes, I had three grandchildren. Also, two girls and one boy.
Oh, that's funny that it worked out like that. And and your wife volunteered for a long time out here. When did she stop volunteering?
I expect she volunteered for 7 or 8 years before she stopped.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Is there any questions I should have asked you? Anything you would like to add?
No, I don't think so. I think we've covered my career with the museum pretty thoroughly.
Okay.
As well as my career in medical practice.
All right. Well, thank you so much for this interview.
You're welcome.